51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 2023 Cannes Film Festival opened on May the 16th and it closes tomorrow. As always, it's been a 10-day extravaganza of glitz, glamour and premieres behind which the movers and shakers of the film world cut their various deals. Tara Brady has been soaking it all up from the Promenade de la Croisette to the innumerable all-day screenings. She joins me now. I have to say, Tara, you join us from, I don't know what the weather is like in the south of France, and I don't care, because you join us in a very, very sunny and clear blue sky Dublin with wonderful temperatures. How is it there? Raining, well, I hope.
Actually, now you make a very good point, and bonsoir, by the way. But you make a very good point, because this was actually the rainiest Cannes I've ever been at. It rained for, it's now not raining anymore, but it did rain for the first few days and very much dampened the mood. And I was standing in a queue for the zone of interest, and an elderly German man came over to me, very lovely man, and insisted he share his umbrella with me. And he looked up at the sky and went, "It's always raining in France."
Well, do you know what? I think this sympathy of the nation will be with you, really, and and be very thankful to the German man. How gallant of him to arrive
he was a lovely guy. We had a lovely chat.
Well, it's good to know that chivalry is alive and well and living in the south of France, the rainy south of France, that is, of course. All right. you've mentioned the zone of interest there, and let's go straight to that, of course, based on the book by Martin Amis, obviously, who coincidentally died while the festival was on. There was a lot of mystery surrounding this, Tara. What was that all about? Whether it even existed?
I mean, it's the absolute strangest thing. I mean, for about, I think, 2-3 years, people have been going, this film might be coming out. We're really looking forward to this. This is Jonathan. But nobody actually knew if he had shot it. There was so much secrecy around it. There was word that he had been shooting something in Poland, but no one was sure if it was this project or something else. And, you know, and then sort of very sadly, you know, it comes one day after it premieres in Cannes, Martin Amis dies. Now, it's worth noting that it has very, very little. It's very, very loosely adapted from the Amis novel. It's entirely movie project. It's something that could only exist as a movie. And the moment it turned up and we did realize it exists, it was hailed as a masterpiece. And I couldn't possibly disagree with that. It's just an extraordinary film. I mean, the first thing to say about it is that so much of it is about the sound. If you remember Mika Levi, he did all those kind of strange sounds in Jonathan Glazer's last film, Under the Skin. And here and you just don't forget them at all. And, you know, here that's ramped up even more. And it ties in with sort of two things, because the film is set in Auschwitz. It's set in a concentration camp. So, you know, it ties in with that Adorno idea that, you know, you can't represent the Holocaust effectively. But it also is that thing about the things that you hear on and you don't see on screen. Often they're the worst things, because that's where your imagination doesn't know where that you just imagine much worse than you can see. So it concerns the commandant of Auschwitz, Rudolf Haas, and his wife, Hedwig. And they've built this absolutely perverse dream house and garden for their children adjacent to the camp and their loving life. And we're constantly immersed in all these sounds of bird song and birthday parties and children's laughter. But all the while, there's this low industrial hum coming from next door. You know, when people lie down at night and they're cozy in their beds, there's this hum and it never goes away. Yeah. And occasionally you'll hear maybe a gunshot, or occasionally you hear screams, and it's the noises that just really, really stay with you. Right. And it kind of runs contrary to, you know, we've seen films like in recent years, like Downfall or Natural Light, where they've tried to go, well, you know, fascists were people too, or they had some kind of lives, or they had, but this one is absolutely the opposite, because everything about their family life is just, just to stress their kind of monstrousness. Yeah. And like you see, Hedwig is walking around in a fur coat that she's clearly got from somebody who's been brought into the camp. And she sits around and has these kind of girls' coffee mornings, and they're exchanging stories about things that they've
seen and heard. But this sounds like an absolute must-see from what you're saying. Now, one of the big must-sees are the ones, that was being anticipated highly before the festival started, was the new Indiana Jones film. something of a disappointment, I believe.
Yeah, the Indiana Jones film has kind of gone down with a big thud. It's currently at 51 on Rotten Tomatoes, and a bit like The Rain, it's sort of very much dampened, I think, the first weekend at Cannes. It hasn't gone over as well as anyone expected. And that was kind of the big Hollywood splashy film, I suppose, that was opening alongside Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which did in fact kind of that made up the ground for the other Hollywood film, because it's currently at 91 on Metacritic, and most everybody loves it, even though it is 3.5 hours long. So make sure that you've been working out your glutes
before you go there. All right, but the Todd Haynes movie, I suppose, was another one that there's a bit of excitement around. May December is the title here, starring Natalie Portman. We'll come back to her dress shortly. A couple of pictures that I want to tweet.
We will.
Let's talk about the film first of all. May December.
This is just a camp classic in the making. You can see like this being a kind of Rocky Horror Picture Show film where in years to come, people are going to be rocking up to cinemas and going to screenings and shouting out their favorite lines of dialogue. It's just so deliciously dark and incredibly camp. And it's Todd Haynes' best and most fun film. It's right. Best film since Far From Heaven, and most fun film since his kind of early films. It's based very loosely on, I don't know if you remember, Mary Kay Letourneau, and she was that American high school teacher who was jailed in 1997 for having sex with a student who at the time was only 12 years old. And both parties always claimed the relationship was consensual, and they continued the relationship while she was serving her sentence. She got pregnant twice during that time, and then after she was released, they got married, and they were married in fact until 2019. So May December is very loosely inspired by that. It cast Julianne Moore as Gracie, who has three grown-up children with Joe, who she first got together with whilst they were both working in a pet shop when she was like 36 and he was 13. Yeah. And as the film opens, Natalie Portman, who's a famous movie star, she's playing a famous movie star, she is coming to the house, and she's going to study Gracie and her family, because she's going to be playing Gracie in a movie. Oh. And there's this shot very, very near the beginning when Julianne Moore opens her fridge and bemoans the lack of hot dogs. And there's this crash zoom, and there's dramatic music. And that is very much the entire tone of the film. There's a breakdown scene, a complete nervous breakdown over a blueberry pie later in the movie that is, you know, the worst dessert-related trauma you've ever seen in the history of cinema.
Okay, well, that's certainly... I know that these you've a couple of five-star ones. Zone of Interest is one. May, December is another. And the latest from Wim Wenders, This Is Perfect Days. You're tipping this, its lead star for the Best Actor Award, yeah?
Oh yeah, absolutely, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of older actors back here this year. Ken Loach, who I've just seen his new film, which is lovely, and Wim Wenders is one of them at 76. He hasn't made a feature film in a long time. He's made a few docs. This is his first feature in many years, and it's his best feature since really his heyday, like of Paris, Texas, and that sort of era. It's a really lovely little thing. It obviously references Yasujirō Ozu and like a classic Japanese cinema like that. It stars Koji Yakuzo as Hirayami. He's a contract cleaner who works cleaning Tokyo's public lavatories. He hardly says anything. He just has his routine. Yeah. He gets up because he has his coffee. He listens to kind of Lou Reed and David
Bowie.
But enough in his performance
for you to think that he's up for a Best Actor Award here, yeah.
Yeah, very much so. It's really a film that's all about taking pleasure in the kind of like small joys in life, like looking up at the sky, and it's a wonderful film.
You have a dark horse in the midst of all of this, Club Zero. Now, this has kind of divided people, I think. Some have been totally appalled by this movie. You are tipping it, however, for a possible award, yeah?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, it's a very, very black comedy, and it really pushes it's from Jessica Hausner, who previously did Little Joe. It stars Maya Wasikowska as this mysterious teacher who's an attrition teacher who comes into this very swanky English boarding school and encourages the children towards like what she calls conscious eating. Yeah. So it's a really good satire about, you know, charlatans and about diets and all those kind of things. Yeah. And eventually this kind of teenage cult forms around her, and they want to join Club Zero, which is not eating at all.
Well, let's listen to a clip. I have a clip here which gives a real sense of that kind of really dark sides to the film itself. It centres around food and dieting, as you said. One of the students in the school, Ragna, played by Florence Baker here, is at home with her parents, played by Keely Forsyth and Lucas Turter, and they're serving her vegan food, thinking naively that they are doing the right thing. And here's a clip from Club Zero.
This is vegan. Just for you.
Seriously? Vegan is so out.
Oh. So how's a new teacher? As sophisticated as she claims on her website? I ordered her tea online.
Yeah, her program is supposed to be very healthy. We were reading, and it could help you watch your weight.
Why should I watch my weight?
Well, it might help to improve your performance on the trampoline.
Don't worry, darling. Mum didn't mean it. So, how about you show us how to eat consciously? We'd love to see how it works. Right?
Yeah.
It's really easy.
Florence Baker, Keely Forsyth and Lucas Turter in a scene there from Club Zero, one of the dark horse films from Tara Brady from this year's Cannes Film Festival. Of course, there's no point in talking about Cannes if we don't talk about the attire and the elegance of it all, apart from the wonderful elegance of that German man and his umbrella. I'm tweeting at RTE Arena at the moment a picture of Natalie Portman in what I have to say, to my eye, is an absolutely beautifully elegant dress that she wears magnificently.
It is. I know you're disappointed, John, Sean, because we normally talk about the big Dolce & Gabbana dresses, and they haven't had many big dresses this year, though they did have a pantsuit for Phoebe Waller-Bridge's at one of the Indiana Jones events. Mm. But Natalie Portman, she turned up in this, it's called a Juno dress, and it's based on Christian Dior's original 1949 frock. And originally when she turned up on it, people actually thought it was the real frock, but of course it couldn't be, because that's in the Metropolitan Museum of Art in wow. New York. It's also priceless, and it's also made of gelatin, so if you were to walk out in it, it would be immediately destroyed, especially if you were to walk out
in
into
the rain.
Kind of or rain, that would be the absolute end of it. But this is a new version that's made by Dior's creative director, but it is absolutely so beautiful. Yeah. I mean,
elegance,
people who don't know about
that. Yeah, even let me put my hand up on that front, but the elegance the understated nature of it, in total contrast to the next one I'm going to tweet at RTE Arena. Banana dress is what Heidi Klum is wearing. I've heard this is described as, what were you thinking? It was one of those moments. There's a lot of yellow, but not enough yellow in very important areas, it would seem.
So worth saying, Zuhair Murad, who designed that gown, is a very, very good designer, but I think this is an unusual misfire. This was on the red carpet for Pot of Few, which is like the most gourmand-friendly film of all time. That'll be coming in soon, and you know, it makes Babette's Feast look like curry chips from Supermax at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the dress was kind of more the curry chips end of things. It's obviously Heidi Klum looks fantastic. But she's wearing this very high slit caped gown, and then with this huge diamond cut out of the chest. Yeah. And there was, in fact, a wardrobe malfunction. And, you know, even for those of us who aren't particularly keen on American football, we will say that that's one of the great things, gifts of American football to the world, the phrase wardrobe malfunction. there was some slippage, but you do have to look at the dress and go, the main malfunction was putting it on in the first place. You know, because if she sat down in a big nest, it would look like she was auditioning for Sesame Street.
It certainly would. I'm not sure what you'll be wearing to your final sets of screenings, but clearly you'll have an umbrella with you. That has given me such joy, that rain detail from the south of France. But Tara, listen, I look forward to seeing you back at base soon, and enjoy what's left of the festival. That's Tara Brady there, reporting from the Cannes Film Festival, which concludes tomorrow. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. When West Side Story opened on Broadway in 1957, it transformed musicals. With Leonard Bernstein's score, Stephen Sondheim's lyrics and choreography by Jerome Robbins, the show was a pulsating take on Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, transposed to the mean streets of New York, with rival gangs, the Jets and the Sharks. West Side Story gave exhilarating life to the interracial tensions and class injustices that plagued the America of the day, and some would say still do. A new revival of the show is coming to Bord Gáis Energy Theatre next month. Chris O'Rourke saw the production in Frankfurt. He joins me now. I mean, I suppose, Chris, for most people, when they think of West Side Story, I think they'll think of the film, you know, the 1961 film, which brought the stage show to the big screen. But this show that's coming to the Bord Gáis is going right back to those theatrical roots in 1957. How is it doing that, and how different is that from the familiar film?
It's, I mean, you're absolutely right. It is. It returns back to the 1957 musical. So, in a sense, there's certain differences in term, and I don't want to kind of give away too much here, because certain dance sequences that you see in the movie are performed differently in the musical.
In the stage show.
But I suppose essentially the story remains the same. A lot of the scenes remain the same. What makes this different, I think, is at the time, this was way ahead of its time. And it's dealing, as you said, with the interracial tensions. And there's a very deliberate effort in this production to look back at that from a contemporary perspective and say, OK, what have we learned and where are we at today?
Essentially, we're talking the Romeo and Juliet story, as I said, you know, put into the New York City. And it's love across the divide, essentially, isn't it?
It is. It very much is. But there was, you know, that production and the Spielberg production in 2021 were dogged by this thing of, have the Puerto Ricans, who will be the Sharks, been given proper representation or given equal representation? So there's very much an effort with this production to say, OK, let's balance that. Let's have equal time, you know, for the Jets and the Sharks in terms of how they're presented. So in that regard, you have, for example, Julio Monge, who's a choreographer, who originally worked with Jerome Robbins on a production of sort of like his greatest hits in the 80s. So he's very familiar with Robbins' choreography, but he's Puerto Rican.
That brings a whole new flavour to the choreography, I'm guessing.
It does. It accentuates things that were there, but maybe we didn't notice. So, I mean, Bernstein, for example, he was a musical encyclopedia. But what a lot of people may not have realised, say, for example, in the dance hall scene, where the two gangs sort of square off, it's the mambo.
Yeah.
It's not rock and roll. This is 1957, but it's the mambo.
Yeah.
So those kind of little subtle flavours are allowed a little bit more breathing room.
So rather than the rock and roll of the white Americans, this was the mambo of the Puerto Ricans. You spoke to the choreographer, in fact.
I did, yes.
Let's have a little listen to what he had to say about it. And it is the music of the mambo that we will hear as we head in, and the mambo from the film, that is, that we will hear as we head into listening to Julio Monge.
Bernstein was very aware, and he was a lover of music of all of the Americas. He understood it all and devoured it all, and he was an admirer of those sounds. And he knew that Puerto Ricans and mambo were a huge thing.
Yeah.
And if you were in New York in the 1950s, there was a place called the Palladium, which was the Palace of Mambo. And it was one of those few places, because remember, that was still under the segregation laws, etc.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't have whites and blacks together, or Hispanics,
exactly,
or Asian,
yeah,
in many places. But the Palladium was an exception, and it was a universal space, and Jews and Italians and Puerto Ricans and blacks were all there. And that's the story I tell them. I was teaching at a studio in New York City, and there's a lady outside watching. And I gave the dancers a break. The kids came back and they say, you know, this lady outside was in the original West Side Story.
Wow.
I said, please ask her to come in. And we talked, and She told us a few stories, and I asked, do you remember the choreography? She says, when Jerry teaches it to you, you don't forget.
Yeah. That's an extraordinary story. That's Julia Munge there speaking to Chris, who's with me in studio this evening, Chris O'Rourke, who saw the new production of West Side Story that's coming to the Borgosh Energy Theatre with the choreography, the new choreography from Julia Munge. That's an extraordinary story about that woman from the original production.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it highlights the fact that you know, West Side Story is one of those musicals, even like if you were a punk or a metalhead, it's cool to like.
Yeah.
It's that good. Mm. And in this one, Jerome Robbins, who in the 1957, wasn't just a choreographer, he directed it.
Yeah.
And it's almost like he's aspiring to make it into an American ballet with folk songs. So the choreography is crucial. In so many dances at the moment, it's decorative. But to this, it's crucial.
Yeah, so in this production, the choreography really leads the telling of the story.
Yes.
You were also telling me about the Maria that is cast in this production, and it will be that Maria who's coming to Dublin.
Yes. Her name is Melanie Sierra. She's Puerto Rican. And in a sense, what is remarkable about her, Maria, is so often Maria is played as a young woman, as a young girl.
Yeah.
And this, you see that transition from a young girl into womanhood. Because, you know, West Side Story is essentially her story. You know, this is a world where men die and women endure. So we follow her from the innocent I am pretty, oh so pretty, into somewhere, and then the very poignant ending. And there's a few little touches that Lonnie Price brings as director, and that Melanie brings as a performer, that you're not seeing a Disney princess here. You're seeing somebody who starts off as a Disney princess but evolves into a more full-fledged
role. Real character development.
Exactly.
Here.
So more in keeping where we are today. So, you know, she's not being protected by the men. She's somebody who has her own agency. So, again, speaks to a modern audience.
Let's have a listen to a little bit. And this is from the current cast. Jaden Webster is playing the part of Tony, and Melanie Sierra, as you said, playing the part of Maria. And this is their big duet. And that's the singers from the current production of West Side Story, which is coming to the Borgosh Energy Theatre next month. Chris O'Rourke has been to see it for us. He's with me in studio this evening. That's Jaden Webster as Tony and Melanie Sierra as Maria. And the minute I heard that, Chris, it struck me, this kind of saccharine sweet quality that sometimes you get to Tony and Maria, it's not there. It's still a beautiful melody and it's a beautiful duet. But that kind of, you know, awful sugary quality seems to be gone. How have they managed that?
I think you're absolutely right. This is a much more robust and a much more relatable Tony and Maria. And I think the two cast members, Jaden and
Melanie,
are terrific. They have a wonderful chemistry, and individually they're very conscious of what they're doing. I spoke to them briefly, and they have a very deep understanding of what they wanted to do and not just imitate what was done before. But I think, you know, Lonnie Price's direction again is significant. So, for example, you know, it all pivots on the scene where Tony comes to her bedroom and tells her what happened with her brother. I'm sure people know, but I'm not going to, just in case. And they spend the night together. But the next morning when Anita arrives, she comes in, she knows something went down. And, you know, she goes over, pulls away the bedsheet and examines the bedsheet. If you're an adult, you know what that means.
Yeah.
If you're a kid, it just goes over your head. But you're suddenly aware, oh, I'm in a very different story now. This is much more meat to the bone.
Yeah, and often it is the case that Anita and Bernardo take over the story and Tony and Maria get lost. It sounds as if this production is much more balanced in that respect.
Absolutely. You're 100% right. It does, even to the extent at times where it really is Maria's story and Melanie very much brings that to the foreground. And Anita becomes what she was originally and always meant to be, which is a supporting character.
Yeah, so that again sounds as if they've got the balance right. But I'm guessing the dance sequences when you see them on stage in front of you must be very exciting.
They are. And particularly if you're familiar with them or if you're familiar with Jerome Robbins' work. But even if you're not, you know, if you ask anybody who saw the movie, you know, how does it open? You know, and everybody remembers that.
Yeah.
They're cultural icons, the dance steps now at this point. And it's wonderfully well done. Like Lonnie Price, in terms of the set design, it seems to swirl and pivot and turn almost like the dancer. So the choreography seems to infuse everything from the character to the design to the whole experience. And it's visually and kind of emotionally powerful.
This sounds as if it's a ticket. It's going to be a hot ticket when it gets here, Chris.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it should be. I mean, you can say you've seen it before, but there's something distinctly different here. You're going to get the West Side Story you're familiar with, but you're going to get some other things going on that make this just a little bit special.
All right. Well, let's finish up with a bit of finger clicking. And I'll give full details out about the where and when of West Side Story in the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre after we click our way through this. Stuff indeed. Cool there from the production of West Side Story that is coming to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre from June the 14th through until the 24th. And indeed, Chris O'Rourke just saying as we were speaking here that the Lonnie Price who directed this production is the same Lonnie Price has directed the Gabriel Byrne One Man Show Walking with Ghosts that we saw recently. However, the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre West Side Story, June the 14th through to the 24th, tickets available on ticketmaster.ie. And so to our album reviews, as usual in the last half hour of Friday evening. Back a couple of years ago, Edgar Wright's documentary Through the Sparks Brothers, that's Ron and Russell Mayall, back into the limelight. They intend to stay there with the release of a new album called The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. British singer-songwriter Arlo Parks is also back with her second album. It's called My Soft Machine. And American musician Kevin Morby has released a follow-up, or as he calls it, a continuum to last year's This Is Photograph. It's called, the new album that is called More Photographs. Pat Carty and Zara Hedeman have been listening to all of that and they join me now. We're going to start with Sparks, The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. Classic Sparks, I suppose, in its title. 26 albums, 52 years. This is how do you even start to summarise a career like that, Zara?
You kind of don't. And I suppose everything that has been said about Sparks has been, but I suppose it's important to reiterate just how throughout that career, how inventive and original they've been and how influential they've been too.
Yeah.
I mean, you have people as varied as Joy Division, Franz Ferdinand, Bjork, all citing how their music changed their world. And when you go through their discography and when you dip into like 70s releases, 80s releases, and even to like The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte, they're so fresh and it's very hard to place, I think, when those albums come out because of their originality. And I guess as well that is down to how they don't compromise their own tastes.
Yeah,
and
I don't know if you saw that documentary, Pat, at the time, the Edgar Wright documentary. It really laid into that whole idea that you could, from album to album, they changed almost at times fundamentally, except for the two of them at the very centre of it all. And of course, they were part of the modern drama opera Annette, which they created the music for. All of this brought them back into the highlight, I suppose, or into the spotlight in recent times. Hmm. Even the way you haven't looked me in the eyes since you came into studio, Pat, makes me think that perhaps you are not in the Sparks Brothers.
I did see that documentary you're talking about. I thought it was very good, and the fact that I'm not a fan, and I still thought it was very good, and I thought they were very likable, and I do, as Zara was saying, admire any act that does that change around. I mean, I was going through the stuff when they changed from being, say, the glam rock early years, if you could call it that, to working with, say, Giorgio Moroder and doing stuff like that. And as Zara said, influencing a whole host of artists.
Yeah.
And also there was a night, you know, because they've had so many albums, there was a Sparks Spectacular in London a few years ago where they did 23 or 24 nights in a row and played a different album every night. Now, that's cool. Yeah. If you're a fan, I mean, you'd be going along and you'd be buying.
I suppose most people will think of Sparks. They mightn't even think of Sparks. They'll know this town ain't big enough for the both of us, because that was the big hit. Hmm. So, where are you now after listening to The Girl Who's Crying in Her Latte?
Okay, well, let me say that I have several friends who tell me repeatedly how great Sparks are. And as Zara said to me earlier on, they did a night in Vicar Street. Was it this year, Zara, or was it last year?
No, last year, I think it was.
And I'm told by several people that this was amazing and I should have been at it. Now, when I put this record on, The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte, right, the first song is The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte. To me, the sound that came out is like, it's like the sound of a thousand printers or photocopiers malfunctioning and screaming for revenge. I think when the AI wars are finished and our bodies lay cast on the final battlefield, this is the music that will be played by the machines at the celebratory party. It's just... Yeah. And then the lyrics...
And you think Kate Blanchett will be doing the video for it as well?
I mean, that's great, and getting her in and everything thrown shapes. But, I mean, the lyrics, the girl is crying her latte, sad. The girl is crying her latte, bad. I mean... Is that supposed to be insightful or?
Well, let us have a little listen and see what people think. Zara, you'll have to hold that breath until we listen to a little bit of them. Sparks and The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte.
Is it due to the rain? The girl is crying in her latte, yeah. The girl is crying in her latte, sad. The girl is crying in her latte, wow. The girl is crying in her latte, bad.
It has to be said that two-thirds of the studio are bouncing up and down in their chairs and punching the air. One-third of the studio is now opening a bottle of water to get ready for the next assault. Zara, I stopped you at an intake of breath when you wanted to retort, I think, to Pat Carty's comments regarding the wonderful industrial sound, I think we could say we get at the beginning of that.
I think I was just getting excited about hearing that song on the wonderful studio speakers.
Yeah.
Because as Pat was saying, like, he wasn't invigorated by the lyrical content here, but as someone who really likes listening to Sparks, especially for Ron Mayall's very funny and like self-deprecating lyrical style, I found that I was very closely paying attention to what was being said across the album. Like, there's a song, The Mona Lisa's Packing, Leaving Late Tonight, where, like, there's lines about, she might seem dispassionate, but that's not true. No one knew what she was so disturbed. No one knew she was so uptight. And then just even imagining where she's going to go on this, like, imagined holiday. And then later on, there's the song, When You Leave, all about the character who everyone at the party's waiting for them to leave. Yeah. They'll bring out the Belgian beers. I just found it very funny, like.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, Pat. Like, the girl is crying in her latte, bad. The girl is crying in her latte, sad.
Yeah.
I think there might be some irony, perhaps, at play there.
Is that it?
Yes, I think that possibly might be what it is.
Well, look, there's a song there called Nothing Is As Good As They Say It Is, right? Which is my retort to the friends who told me this was going to be good. But the other thing is, I think, and I may be wrong, and Zara can correct me here, I think it's about a baby being born and deciding that this is not a great place to be. Who could blame the baby if this is what's playing?
Okay, well, my retort to that is the song I'm now about to play, which is for you, Pat.
Right.
Doesn't have to be that way.
They always said that you cannot change your mind. Do it once and you're defined. Do it twice and you're divine. Pay for it, I'll pay for it. No single lie.
There was a moment, Pat Carty, in the middle of that song. He said, "Now that's all right."
Yeah, that's
and
all right.
Finally, we have him converted.
Yeah, that's okay. It's a bit, there's a touch of the Beatles, or maybe more ELO
going
on there.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be that way from Sparks.
Again,
yeah.
The thing that maybe upsets me a bit is just got to the chorus there and maybe he tries to pile in too many syllables. I'm not trying to say that. I would get you towards the irony part of the dictionary. And again, look, this just isn't for me. But that's not to say that I don't admire Sparks for their going, following their own path, doing their own thing. Doesn't sound like anyone
else. You just want your friends not to blackball you for the rest of the night. It gets an emotion out of me.
We'll come to another record later on where there's just no emotion at all. So,
okay, so I mean, this is something. There's something there. Yeah. So, Stars, I fear to ask.
I give it two and a half.
He kind of blithely throws them out. Zara.
I feel that Ron and Russell, they haven't lost their initial spark over all those 50 years.
That's good.
So for me, it's 3.5.
3.5 from Zara. Okay. That's Sparks' first album up this evening. The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte with Cate Blanchett in the video. Has to be worth it even for that. Let's move on then to album number 2, Arlo Parks. This is a totally different set of proposition altogether. My Soft Machine. Her first stadium gig was in the Aviva in 2022. She played support to Harry Styles in his sellout gig. Her debut album was Collapsed in Sunbeams, won a Mercury Prize, and now she's back with this second album, My Soft Machine. And, you know, phrases like meteoric rise, et cetera, are often bandied around. But in the case of Arlo Parks, Pat, I think it's safe to say it. Like, she really has. She hit the ground running and she just rocketed up from there. 2018 was the first?
2018. Uploading demos to the BBC or something like that. And then just picked up straight away. As you said, Mercury Prize. And then the same album was nominated for a Grammy, I think, for Best Alternative Album. Played Glastonbury, played with Harry Styles, Graham Norton, later breakthrough artist at the Brits, all that stuff almost straight away. It's like
and huge
checking
success.
A bingo card.
First album was a huge
success, massive.
Critically. And were you in accord with the critical acclaim at the time?
Not really, but, you know, so what?
All right. However, I think all three of us were stopped in our tracks, well, I certainly was, by the opening track on the album. Very short track, 1:12, so I'll let it play in full. Really could pick any line in that 1:12. I wish it was 7 and Blameless is one that I heard even more that time around than I heard it when listening to it earlier on today. She lays out what she lays out in that opening track is potentially very disturbing. In fact, how does it differ? Where is she now in comparison to what she was doing with album number one? Which is, what did you do there and what you're doing now, Sarah?
So essentially what I think was part of the acclaim with that first album was people were remarking on her ability to go between versatility and vulnerability. And she wrote a lot about trauma and anxiety and her experiences with that. And that does carry through to this album. And what is added to that then is her experiences of first time heartbreak. With that song in particular, Bruiseless, when I heard that, like you, Sean, I was really struck by it, especially the line, where everyone I love is abused and I'm included, and the guilt that she felt
about not saving other people from harm.
Exactly.
All of those things really upsetting.
So
to
from
to.
There I was really invested and I was like, geez, this sounds actually quite interesting. The song is 1 minute long and I think that the power of that song is actually its brevity, because I did feel that, you know, with great success comes great pressure, which is what she had obviously with the first album. And I found that the pressure was sometimes felt in some of the lyrical structural decisions we hear throughout the album, and it became more apparent the more I listened to it, where that initial allure of the album that really draws you in diminished quite quickly because she has phrases that she repeats quite a lot, and I felt that that was maybe because she didn't have enough time to write.
You're agreeing with a lot of that, Pat. I mean, she goes on to deal with, she said herself, I think, about this, that it's all about mid-20s anxiety, you know, falling in love for the first time, self-sabotage, joy. Again, really important themes and topics to be singing about, and to be singing them to you know, people of her own age who might find some comfort and, you know, solace in what she's saying. But you were in agreement with a lot of what Zara was saying in terms of starts well, but...
Yeah, I mean, I thought that, the same as both of you, I thought that was striking, and I was reminded maybe a bit of Erykah Badu or someone like that, or Lauryn Hill, and I thought that's what I was expecting. I thought this was going to be great. It's not great at all. The stuff you're saying about the 20s, of course that's important. I mean, I spent a full decade in my 20s, I remember it well, and we all went through that. And but I just, like, to take the singles that preceded this album, right? You have Weightless, and you're listening to it, and you think, right, that's decent pop song, and Impurities, decent pop song, you know. Embrace My Impurities and I Feel Clean Again, Blades, another mid-tempo, gentle kind of pop song. Your Eyes Are Starting to Droop a Bit, you know. Pegasus with Phoebe Bridges, you know. Let Me Guess Before I Even Put It On, mid-tempo love song with the same whispery vocals. The Spectre of Dido rose up here. And, you know, I mean,
not in a good way.
This is the sound that Beige makes. You know, this is the sound that a tumbleweed makes. In fact, this is the sound a tumbleweed makes when there's nobody looking at it. It's that you could play it in a library and nobody would be going, shh, there's nothing. It doesn't really grab you at all.
I actually saw who you described one of the songs as exceptionally bland. Exceptionally. And I wondered, was that an oxymoron or not? It's the one that features poor old Phoebe Bridgers.
Dulux, the fellas in Dulux would be looking for a less offensive shade of beige.
All right, let's have a listen to A Touch of Pegasus. This is Phoebe Bridgers as part of this. This is GS.
Falling asleep, holding your puppy in your Prussian blue sheet. Never felt luckier than I do right now. Tell me you love me, let me have it. You're special cause you told me.
That's Pegasus featuring Phoebe Bridgers from Aura Parks and My Soft Machine. I know what a fan you are of Phoebe Bridgers. I know, Zara. I can't resist this because you had a real go at her recently. What was that album? What was the album? It was the album with the three of them on it.
Boy Genius.
Sorry. Thank you very much. Yeah, you were not happy about the Phoebe Bridgers thing. Are you happy to see her on here with Arlo Parks?
I should have expected it. I should have known. But when I actually listened to the song, it's fine because she's actually just basically not there, really. It's very phoned in.
Like the rest of the song. Yeah.
It's just a bit phoned in, and I don't think it was necessary. I think there's other artists, especially in London, who are Arlo Parks' contemporaries that would have been better shouts to get involved.
All right. I kind of half agree with both of you on the, it starts really well with that minute and 12, but unfortunately we do kind of get lost then subsequent to that. How does that all add up for you, Zara?
You know, I don't think that this is necessarily the difficult second album. I think there's elements that are okay. Parks, I think, is a good presence and I liked listening to her. So I'm going to give it a 3 because I think there is an artist in there who needs just a bit of time.
You want the Bruiseless...
Yep.
Artist to come to the fore. And what are you saying, Pat?
I don't know. It's not even really, it's just not there. I don't know if I can mark it. It just doesn't make any impression at all.
She made an album and you enjoyed the first
album. And
you enjoyed at least a minute and 12 seconds of it.
I don't know. 2. There you go.
2. All right. You're in a very non-committal mood this evening. Well, in your stars, but not in your opinions, Pat. Let's move on to Kevin Morby's album, More Photographs. Nod back to last year's This Is a Photograph. Metaphor of a photograph to look back on memories and the passage of time. A continuum is what he calls this new album, More Photographs, a continuum. And that suggests that there may be more to come. This Is a Photograph 2 is the opening track, isn't it? Yes, it is.
This is a photograph, a dark horse from your past galloping back. Open up your mouth and laugh.
Having a lot of fun looking at his photographs. And this album is Kevin Morby, More Photographs of Continuum, the follow-on from This Is a Photograph. The thumb sketch of Kevin Morby and what he's done to date, Zara?
Texas singer-songwriter, has been around for about a decade, has been a jobbing musician with Woods and has made quite a name for himself in his solo career, is in the kind of same wheelhouse as, say, like a Cass McComb, Steve Gunn, Kurt Vile, does that really nice, lush 70s stuff. His guitar playing in particular was always what drew me to him, especially with his album City Music from 2017. This, as you said, is a return to This Is a Photograph. what he's basically done is just added a bit of strings, kind of been a bit sparser. Much
I
like,
don't know what kind of week you're all having.
About Sparks and Arlo Parks. I just feel that, like that continuing to look at a photograph of yourself, I feel this is a bit too self-indulgent.
Mm. The first album, the previous album, rather, This Is a Photograph, it dealt with the death of his father, and there was genuine emotion in that, Pat. And I remember the reviews of it at the time, I remember listening to it at the time, and it was a moving album. It was hard not to be affected by it. Did you feel like that around... Well, more photographs, yeah, a continuum?
There's a couple of songs on this that are very much adaptations of the ones. So let's say that song we just heard there, which I love the strings on. We were all dancing to it there.
Yeah. Well, you and I were.
You and I.
There was two-thirds of the studio involved in it again this time. Different two-thirds.
The message there again, he's talking about the photograph again and about... This is the stuff he'll miss. You know, the album seems to be obsessed with death a bit. Jeff Buckley is in it and River Phoenix is mentioned and his mother is there in another song, Mickey Mantle's autograph. But in that one, you know, he's talking again about that photograph of his dad and the stuff that you'll miss after you die, yes, which if that's not an oxymoron, if you know what I mean, if that's not a contradiction, the stuff that you miss after you die. And I really liked that song. I really liked Kingdom of Broken Hearts. Well, I didn't really like it, but I liked it.
Okay.
Kingdom of Broken Hearts, but it dips a lot in the middle.
Okay.
You know,
it's so kind of up and down. But let's have a listen to one of the ones you did like then, Kingdom of Broken Hearts. Kingdom of Broken Hearts. I think it's the second last track on the Kevin Morby album, More Photographs, A Continuum. I was asking you, Zara, as we were listening to that, who is that? Who's the female voice? You reckoned Erin Ray, who's also on a previous track, Bittersweet Tennessee, kind of acoustic-y thing. Was that winning you over in any way, Zara?
No, not really, because I just felt that... To be
so
blunt,
gentle how I asked.
I know. No, not really, because there's 9 songs on this album. 3 of them are reimaginings. One's a kind of sequel. A lot of the same melodies are carried over with this. This could have been an EP. I do just think that there's not enough distance, I don't think, between the two albums to warrant the actual existence of this, to be honest. Because I, at times listening to it, had to make sure that I was listening to A Continuum and not This Is a Photograph from last year.
And just listening to what you said there, there's not enough here to justify its actual existence.
Yeah.
That's what you just said, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Wow. Okay. So, is it getting any stars?
Initially, I think I was feeling generous on my earlier listens and I gave it 3, but I actually think the more I listen to it, the more I think about it, it's a 2.5.
It's the 2.5.
Because I do like the strings quite a lot.
Yeah, they're lovely pizzicato strings in the midst of that Broken Hearts, which I particularly liked, and I loved the percussion at the beginning of This Is a Photograph too as well.
Pretty
Pat,
insightful.
What are you saying
Pretty
overall?
Insightful there, Sean.
Thank you very much.
What would I say? There is a couple of songs I like on this, and there's a couple of bits in maybe each song that I like as well. So I'd give them 3.
Give him three.
Yeah. It's okay.
All right. Yeah. Good job it's not raining outside. Nobody would have got any stars from either of you. All right. But you are entitled to your opinions. That is what it's all about, isn't it? Kevin Morby, More Photographs of Continuum. Arlo Parks, My Soft Machine. The Girl Is Crying in Her Latte from Sparks, the 3 albums that Zara Hedeman and Pat Carty speaking to us about this evening. I'll give you more pizzicato strings on Sunday afternoon on RT Lyric FM. Look at that for a segue.